Okay. How many... I'm trying to look around here. How many of you were here yesterday? Do any of us look familiar in the room? We're up front. Okay. Well, because part of what we were trying to do when we originally created this two-stage sequence is we didn't know who was going to be coming for two in a row and who was going to only be coming once. Because at the beginning we were thinking that this was going to be done in two different venues with different audiences. And so some of what you saw yesterday you will see in a more abbreviated form today. But there will also be a much more expanded discussion at the end of how to apply the model that I'm going to describe. But some of this is going to be a description of a program that I evaluated over the last couple of years that trains youth leaders, essentially training the mentors. So this will have some overlap with what Gary had talked about too in terms of some of the implications. Okay, first of all, purposes. Number one, this presentation will explore the role of faith-based organizations in influencing community change so that it benefits not just public health, but a number of different areas, mental health and community change. Secondly, I'm going to go over some brief research findings from this major national program as an example. And then at the end, we're going to discuss roles and strategies for how churches can actually address some of these community problems and risk behaviors. And as Gary mentioned already, mentoring is one model, and this will add a few other components as well to that model. It will include mentoring, but there's some other ideas as well. So a little bit of literature background. For those of you that were here yesterday, a bit of redundancy, but first of all, we do know that risk behaviors are among the top causes of disease and early death, especially among poor urban youth. That's a real challenge, and depending on where you go in the world, you're going to find that the poorer a community is, the more risk behaviors there happen to be. Children and youth, though, who are connected to families and communities and other faith-based institutions, they're just less likely to engage in those kinds of risk behaviors. That happens in research study after research study after research study. When you are connected with caring adults, when you are connected with a faith that affirms you and that affirms who you are and affirms you as a person, you are just less likely to do those kinds of risky behaviors and make bad choices. For those of you that were here yesterday, I introduced a concept that many of you may not have heard, that some of you may, called social capital. And so the idea is, definition is the sum of active connections, and the idea here is, real relationships among people. Trust, mutual understanding, shared values and behaviors that bind people together in these human networks and communities and make change possible. And that's the focus that we're going to have today, is that how do these relationships and networks actually create change? A little bit more literature. We know that social capital has been linked to an increase in social and civic life. So people are more likely to vote. They're more likely to be involved in their communities. They're more likely to try and create change within the organizations and the communities that they're a part of. We know that people in communities where there's high levels of social capital have more economic development. They have overall well-being. They also are less likely, if they have low social capital, it's been linked to lower levels of physical and emotional health, as well as depression and mortality. I mean, these are things that we've been talking about all this week, is that when people feel connected, when people feel appreciated, when people feel loved in one way or the other, they're likelier to be healthier, they're likelier to be happier. So we know all of those things. But there are a few dimensions that we've looked at more carefully in the literature, and those are three definitions that are breaking down social capital more closely. And the first one is bonding capital. This is the one that we're the most familiar with. Bonding capital is what takes place between similar people with strongly shared commitments. So family, friends, those individuals that we spend a lot of time with, those bonds that take place just naturally and hopefully regularly in our lives. And bonding capital is incredibly important, and that's a lot of what makes people happy and healthy. But there's a second and a third form of social capital as well. The second form is called bridging capital. Bridging capital happens when there is overlapping interests of people who may not have any obvious bonds, but they're members of a community or a neighborhood, and they come together because they're concerned about something. They're frustrated about something that's happening and they want to create change within that community. And that community could even be a church community that's wanting to create some sort of a change. But it's bridging in the sense that they are connected together. They're bonded together. I shouldn't use the word bonded. They're connected together in a way that even though they don't have a lot of, you know, family and friends connections, they care about similar things, and so they create change in that way. The third group, the third type of social capital is called linking capital. And this is the links between people or organizations beyond peer boundaries. So it's not just your friends, cutting across status. So it's not just people who look like you and act like you and are associated with you in some way, and enabling people to exert influence and reach resources outside of their normal circles. This is the toughest form of social capital to gain, because what it means is that you need to have some sort of a link that brings you outside of where you normally associate to obtain resources and to create change. And that's a tough one for many communities to develop, because they may have great bonding capital. They may get along well together. They may have a good sort of set of social relationships. They may even have some bridging capital in the sense that they can get together and try and create change. But if they don't have the linking capital, they oftentimes can't create the change because they can't get access to resources. And as we all know, there are some things that you just can't change without resources. And particularly that's the case in poor communities. How can you rebuild a playground if you can't get access to resources? How can you develop some sort of a program for after-school activities if you can't hire somebody and there are no volunteers to run the program? So you need resources, and linking capital helps to provide that. We also know that many faith-based organizations have become involved in changing their communities, are using elements of social capital in attempts to provide community service programs and to reduce risk behaviors and to develop peace and conflict initiatives. They're doing these things because social capital works in order to create change. We also know that the two governments in particular that I'm aware of, U.S. and British government researchers, have started to develop an interest in how social capital works in the role of faith and community building, because social capital is starting to be seen as contributing to better educational attainment, lower crime levels, improved health, more active citizenship, all of these things. And in part, I would argue that the reason why the World Health Organization became interested in the Adventist Church as a partnering organization, or whatever we're calling it, maybe it's not partnering organization, but in a collaborative organization, is that it allows for these networks to be developed across a wide variety of systems and settings, across a wide variety of places in the world. And so these kinds of activities that social capital promotes actually helps to create the change that they're hoping to have happen. So this is even happening now at, I would argue, at the World Bank, and in part this conference is an outgrowth of that. Finally, we know that many ethnic and minority communities have deeply rooted religious commitments, and they lean heavily on faith communities for economic support, for helping them maybe to find jobs, for helping them to develop health services, other kinds of things where they may not have access to resources. And so, particularly in poor communities, social capital is crucial, particularly bonding and linking capital, in order to get them access to the kinds of resources. And oftentimes, the forms of social capital that they have within churches is the primary mechanism and the primary way that change can happen within those communities, is the faith communities. So religion is considered an important factor in civic engagement within these communities as well. Oh, well. Well, that's basically because I was writing up the product of some research that had been done. All right. Well, thank you, Gary. That was very helpful. I'll know not to listen to you again. All right. So let me tell you a little bit about the project that I've been researching. The DeVos Urban Leadership Initiative, or also called DeVULI, is a national evangelical faith-based leadership program. It's not an Adventist-run organization. It was actually funded by the DeVos Family Foundations. And they are an evangelical organization that was interested in putting some money into how do we improve the leadership of adult urban youth leaders. So this isn't a program for kids, it's a program to train adult youth leaders. Okay? The purpose is to try to train the youth leaders with a set of values and very concrete skills that they could then use to go out and create change. And what they were finding is that often is the case with many pastors that are in the communities, is that they oftentimes get burned out, particularly if they don't have a good source of funding, that they work harder than they probably should under very difficult circumstances, particularly in poor urban neighborhoods, and they end up leaving and going off and doing something else. So this was an effort to try and strengthen those individuals and to try and teach them a different way of thinking and a different way of acting. So this was a training program. About 40 participants per year going through this program, 10 to 15 persons from four different cities each year. So a total of about, I'll show you in a second, but about 450 people had gone through the program over 10 years. 15 months it took to train them. So this is not a short term, go to a little seminar on a weekend and then come back and you're ready to do this. This is intensive training. But it includes two national conferences, five city conferences in their own local city with the 15 people that are part of their local group, bi-monthly group meetings, and then individualized leadership mentoring sessions. And this is all based on the notion that there, if you could develop leadership in these individuals, it's not the information that matters as much as it's the values that matter and some practical skills that could help them to become better community leaders. Leadership curriculum was developed by a nationally recognized group of urban youth leaders. The curriculum hasn't been made public yet because they're still refining it, but I'll show you at the very end a website where you can go and you can see what the curriculum looks like, but not in its final form. It's not in a manual yet. It's basically a description at this point. Started in 1997, about 480 participants from 24 cities had completed the training. Just to give you a quick idea, generally they were 36 to 50 years old, about 60%. So about 25% were much younger than that. You can see here about 65% male, 34% female. Ethnically, 50% black and African American, 23% whiter Caucasian, and about 20% Latino Hispanic, and then a few sprinkled for the rest of the groups. And then about 42% had been in ministry for less than 10 years, and another 37% had been about 11 and 20. So a lot of these are, as you would expect for youth leaders, they're younger in their ministry experiences, and not all of them were pastors. Some of them were individuals that worked in YMCAs, which is a youth program within a community, or it could be a variety of other things. Some worked as juvenile probation officers and did this in the weekends and evenings. Many different ways that they came to the program. Okay, survey, basically 70% response rate, about 20 cities that we were able to talk to, 14 people per city. Focus groups, we did a whole bunch of focus groups as well, about 75 people in those focus groups. Okay, very quick findings. I'm just going to hit some highlights. And some of you saw this yesterday, but this is condensed, so it'll be shorter. What you'll see, first of all, is that they were taught a whole set of skills. And these are the skills that they were taught, and I don't have time to break them down for you. You could see that on their website. But they learned how to assess themselves so that they could have better self-understanding. They learned how to do collaboration with other groups and individuals. They learned how to assess their own ministry and what they were good at and what their ministry skills were. They learned how to access resources. Very important to get that linking capital going, because if you can't access resources, you may have the best ideas in the world, but if you have no way of funding them, oftentimes it's not possible to do. Scenario planning, that's planning for your future. Systems thinking, how do you think about your organization and the place that it plays, the role that it plays within the community? And then asset mapping, trying to figure out what are the resources in our community? What can we use to tap into the community's assets? And sometimes those assets aren't physical. They're things that people know and things that people can do. Even in very economically poor communities, assets are very much part of the community. You just have to figure out how to tap into them. They also learned values. These values were the value of balance, meaning that they weren't supposed to work 24 hours, 7 days a week, that they needed some time apart for themselves and to be able to learn that skill, and it is a skill. Accountability. They couldn't just do this on their own. They needed other people within their group of mentors who are self-mentoring each other to keep themselves accountable to their mission and also accountable to the plans that they had. Empowerment. The idea that you need to not only give people skills, but you also have to empower them to act on their own. Interdependence. Not only are people empowered, but they also need to learn the power and value of connecting with other people. Bridging capital that we talked about is part of that. And then leverage is how do we actually use those community resources and the church resources and the youth resources in order to create change. And as you can see from both of those slides, these are people who, when they went through the program, remember there were about 270 people that answered these surveys, look at the number of people that were doing these activities on a daily basis. These values, they were implementing them in their lives on a daily basis. Daily and weekly, if you add those two together, you get a huge number of people that are doing these activities and doing these values on a really regular basis. So part of the model, and I know Gary's model was a very, very simple, streamlined model, this almost takes a more complicated approach that includes information, but it doesn't stop there. It helps people to develop relationships within the training groups, and then they take that information and that training, and then they develop the relationships with the kids. So it's a model that helps teach them, trains them, and then sends them out into their own communities to implement that same model with other people. All right, so bonding capital. Remember, that's the relationships between individuals, families, and friends. And you can see typical six-month period before they went through the training, about 166 youth on average when you took these 270 responses and averaged them all out. They were averaging about 166 youth every 6 months that they were serving. After the program, they doubled that number. So first of all, you can see the program was having an impact just by the number of people that they were interacting with, the number of kids that they were involved with. Now you can also see there's a difference between training and mentoring, and I think Gary did a good job of explaining what mentoring was. It's kind of those deeper bonds and relationships that are developed. But there's also training that can go along as well, teaching people skills that they can then use in order to create change. And you can see here that an average of 128 individuals were trained per graduate for 6 months. So these were the individuals who learned the skills, then took those skills and trained other people. But they also developed much deeper mentoring relationships with about 10 people per graduate that went through. So a lot of people that were being touched, but about 10 people per person that were intensively touched for that more deep bonding relationship that's not just, you know, hey, let's go out for pizza, but hey, let me teach you what I know. Let me teach you the things that are important to me as a way of transferring the values that they had. And then these ministry networks are the third form of bonding. It's really hard to do ministry and to do these programs by yourself. It's really important to develop a network of people that you can rely on and help, not only for the accountability, but also to partner with and to come up with ideas and plans and also to link resources. And so this is the third piece, is the ministry networks. Now, in terms of bridging capital, remember one of the things that happens in bridging capital is people develop these networks and these relationships outside of their friend and family groups. So you can see here, here's what they started to do. They became much more involved in broad ministry networks. They started to reach out outside of their own denominations and started to develop relationships with people in Lutheran and evangelical, other types of evangelical backgrounds. They started partnering with the Catholic churches in their community, started partnering with the mosques in their community. They were starting to see that the community had some common needs that went beyond just what their own little church or their own little ministry could do. So they started to partner more broadly. They started to become more involved in political and civic affairs, which seems a little strange, especially if you're from an Adventist background. We're often, you know, talk about, well, let's not get involved in political or civic affairs because it might taint us. I think this conference, more than any other place that I've ever seen, has said, no, we're not going to get tainted. As long as we know what we believe and we're strong in those beliefs, we can go out and we can develop these relationships and become a part of civic and political life within our communities and actually can create change that way. Volunteer work in the community, you can see that was what Gary talked about. This wasn't just them volunteering themselves, this was them getting youth to get involved in the community as well. So that's an application of what Gary was just describing. And then the whole idea of cross-denominational activities is that not only were they involved in these ministry networks, they were actually actively planning programs and interventions with the kids, for the kids, by the kids, across the neighborhood with other denominational groups. Bridging Capital, you can see that they actually started an average of 3.7 programs per graduate in a typical 6-month period. That's a lot of activities that they were doing per graduate. You can also see about 55% had worked within between 1 and 5 organizations. That's that linking, that's that bridging that we were talking about. Average of 8.8, almost 9 organizations that they were involved with in a average six month period. Think about this. How many churches do you know? How many pastors do you know that are in the Adventist church that oftentimes link, I should say, bridge with other churches and with other groups within their communities? There's oftentimes this fear that we're, you know, going to get tainted, but I would argue that this is an amazing way to start to develop interfaith alliances that can help to create community change. And then finally, graduate partnered, this is what they were doing. After school programs, sexual abstinence programs, teen violence reduction programs, lots of neat programs going on. Linking Capital, that's that third piece. 47% brought in 1 to 5 grants. This is, how do we bring in the resources? How do we actually get money or other forms of resources, volunteers that come in and help them? 47% had written 1 to 5 grants and brought them into their community, an average of 2.8, almost 3 grants per person. Here's where the real rubber meets the road. They had brought in, of the 195 people who answered this question that they had brought in money, they brought in a total of $19 million to their communities. That's a lot of money. Average of $50,000 per person. Talk about leveraging. Talk about asset development. This is where some real power is happening. The typical grants were anywhere between $10,000 to $100,000. There were 15 of the grants that were between $100,000 and $600,000, and there were 7 grants that were average or that totaled $10.5 million. But as you can see here, a lot of the typical grants were much smaller, but they were still bringing in the money. All right, let's discuss what this means and how to apply it. So we already said training and mentoring illustrates bonding and bridging. We also know that as these relationships were strengthened through the training and mentoring, those who trained and mentored were more connected and more able to connect to other individuals and resources, thereby strengthening their churches. So we know that when these kinds of activities are happening, good things come about as a result. We also know that such relationships help communities develop more social capital by connecting the community members as well. So it's not just happening so that the kids are being changed, it's also that the churches are being changed as well. Now that's an important point. And then as new community organizations and partnerships were formed, communities then mobilized. This leads to discussion about the problems and concerns, and then they start to be able to create the changes in the community. Now, let's go to the practical steps. All right. Here are my suggestions for how you would start to go about thinking about creating change. Number one is, I think, first of all, you need to adopt a perspective of improving the community. Now, oftentimes that's not the way we think. We often think, okay, I want to stop my kids in my church from hanging out after school with no adult supervision, and so I'm going to create a program. But you don't oftentimes think, or a lot of people don't think about, how can I actually improve the neighborhood or the community that I'm a part of? And so to think more broadly than just how can I impact my kids to saying how can I impact my community, I think is a shift in the way that you think, because you have to think at the community level if you're going to develop the networks and the relationships. Otherwise, it's going to stay at bonding capital. You're not going to be able to develop bridging and linking capital. It's only going to stay at bonding. And that's great, and that's the model that Gary used, and it's a very important model, but I would argue that this is the next step beyond that. Second, I think it's important to not just kind of go out and try and do it, but to obtain some training on how to create change within the community. Now, there are seminars, there are resources that are on the web. It's so much easier to develop resources than it used to be. And you can do, for instance, if you're on the internet, you can do searches on community development and community building, and those will give you strategies and tips and techniques. And I think it also helps to go and actually get training on some of these concepts, because it helps you to develop the knowledge base, but also a way of developing skills that can then put these activities into practice. Third is to conduct a community assessment of the needs and the assets. Now, this isn't oftentimes done. Oftentimes we do it backwards. We hear of a problem or we see something happening and we say, I got to run and fix it, without knowing what are the resources that we have within the community and how can we tap into those in order to more effectively create change. But we oftentimes will only see the symptom and may not see the actual problem within the church or within the community. So conducting a community assessment is more than just looking around and saying, I wonder what my problems are. It's actually learning how to do an assessment that says, what are the needs within my community? What are the needs that my kids have? It may be that you have to do a little survey. It may be that you learn how to do what's called asset mapping, which is a technique where you learn about how the community is made up of all of these different people with all of these different skills and talents and abilities. And if you only knew what they could do, and if you only knew what they liked to do and what they were skilled at, that you could tap into those individuals. The number one reason why people don't become involved, and this is based on dissertation research that my colleague Karen Stockton did for her research dissertation, the number one reason why people don't become involved is that no one asks them. So if you take an assessment of the assets within your church and within your community, you will find that when people tell you what they're good at, those are the things that they like to do. And if you ask them to become involved, they generally will do that. They won't just walk up to you and say, hey, I'd like to be involved. But if you ask them, they generally will say yes. Fourth, explore, and I guess this is what I was starting to say anyway, is explore the passion of church members. This is once you understand what their assets are, don't just try and do a program by yourself. Find out who in your community cares about this same issue that you do. And besides that, there are so many church members that care about things that you have no idea that they even cared about. And if you find out what they're really passionate about, and if you let them loose and say, how can I help you to achieve this? And then how can we get the kids involved in this vision? You'll find that there's some changes that can take place within the community that you would not have ever expected. Oftentimes we try and do change as a top-down model. You know, the pastor comes in and says, well, everyone, we're going to be doing, you know, such and such a program, and how many of you would like to volunteer? And everybody kind of looks around and kind of hopes that nobody makes eye contact with them, because if they make eye contact, oh boy, I'm going to have to go and pass out literature. But what if they were doing something that they were very excited about? And what if you were able to find out some of those passions and then say, well, what could we do? How could we develop an idea that would involve kids, that would involve the church in a way that would actually create the change? And then you can figure out how to do the linking capital, which is how can we get the resources to bring that about. 35 seconds. Research best practices and model programs. As Gary said in his presentation, everything that he described was best practices or evidence-based. It's what works. If you have a passion for something and you come up with an idea, my goodness, go find out what somebody else has done in that area. It's so much easier than it used to be to Google the terms that you think might be linked or related to those ideas, and find out what else is being done. Oftentimes the federal governments of your countries will have resources that are available, I know that the U.S. government oftentimes has resources within these areas to say, these are what's being done and these are what works the best. Finally, partner with other local churches and community organizations on programs and projects that will improve your community. It takes a certain amount of organizational leadership and a certain number of organizations coming together to solve difficult community problems. Let's say that it's a violence problem within your community. Oftentimes one church alone can't do this. But if 10 churches got together, if 20 churches got together and said, hey, we need to do an initiative that addresses youth violence, or we've got this neighborhood playground that's a place right now where drugs are being sold and where nobody feels safe to go. But if we get 10 churches together and come together on a Sunday and clean some stuff and do some building and maybe get a community organization to fund this so we can get some new equipment and other kinds of things, put up some new fences. I've been told story after story after story about the ways that these groups came together and created changes in their communities that were absolutely overwhelming in terms of the change that they created, because they didn't try and do it in a silo. They didn't try and do it by themselves. They partnered and they connected with others. And that, I think, is the real key to creating that change. And then finally, get to know local and state legislators, because they're oftentimes the ones either that have resources or that can help you to find access to resources. And oftentimes, the state people, they're not nearly as helpful, but the local people, they're actually interested. Like Gwen, whatever her last name was that I can't remember. Yeah, she was amazing, the story about Philadelphia. I mean, think about all of the connections that she created within the city of Philadelphia to create change. And getting to know people like that, that have a vision for change, is oftentimes the way that change actually happens. So anyway, these are the practical steps, and we could probably talk more at the break or during the discussion.